Hello, cinephiles, and welcome to Indie Outlook, the show that sheds light on must-see cinema from the Windy City and around the globe. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm of HollywoodChicago.com. So my guest today is filmmaker Todd Luby. His film Lefty in 2009 was named one of the top 10 movies of 2009 by Matt Pace of the Chicago Tribune's Metro Mix section, a man with very good taste. I know him very well. Mm-hmm. And he's also done many films, Children of Hope, a six-part web series. And he's done, many different – he has many projects that he's juggling at the moment, it seems. He just finished one film, Be Good, which I saw at the Gene Siskel Film Center, which is excellent. And he's also in the midst of adapting a nonfiction book by – Thomas Cahill. So thank you. Welcome to the program. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Matt. It's great.
Absolutely. Well, just first of all, I want to get a little bit into I.O., the Improv Olympic in Chicago, because it seems like that was one of like the first places you got, connected with some actors. You did some performing yourself, I assume. And was there anything when you were at the Improv Olympic that got you more interested in film, kind of prepared you for a career in directing actors, film in general?
I can't necessarily say it was directly related. I had basically wanted, when I was at I.O., I wanted to be an actor. And that was a relatively new sort of realization. When I was in grad school at University of Illinois, I was cast kind of unexpectedly in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Hmm. And I played Cheswick, which was totally out of character and... out of, I guess, form, because I look nothing like, at least the image that people would assume Cheswick could look like. But it went really well, and I just really got the acting bug. Hmm. And so when I moved back to Chicago after I was done with school, I just went to I.O. because I had a buddy, who was in I.O. in Second City, and, he convinced me to come down, and I knew I wanted to keep acting. So... I was taking classes, and in the midst of taking classes, my friend, I like to explain it as he acquired a DV camera, and this was back in like 99 or 2000, and he acquired a DV camera and gave it to me because he knew I was sort of interested in film as well. And once I had that DV camera, I just really never put it down and really just kind of, for the next 10 years, just taught myself how to make films. Definitely, my purpose behind filmmaking initially was to, give myself a platform to act because I didn't, I was never really comfortable with auditions and things like that and waiting around for someone to hire me for this or that. I was like, well, I might as well just make my own movie and that'll be the way I can act and get out in the world. So
sure, absolutely. And I'm always fascinated when I talk to people who are self-taught. Because it seems like everyone has their different method of doing it, and it proves that you don't need necessarily film school. Like, some people need that structure, some don't. I think sometimes what film school provides people is more just connections than anything else.
Yeah.
And so has that been one of the challenges being self-taught? Has it been challenging to kind of get your voice out there, kind of connect with other fellow peers in the filmmaking community?
That's, it's really been a total struggle and continues to be so today is having no connections. And mostly that, you can always find technicians and shooters and things like that relatively easy on like Craigslist or something. But, I feel that a lot of people make these sort of relationships with producers, like sort of while they're in film school. You see people sort of pairing up and then on the film fest circuit, I just see this a lot where, these guys, these directors all have these producers that they've been working with since college, and like that is something like I totally want and has been completely elusive to me is to find a good producer. So that is one, like, the only lament I have for not spending $80,000 to $100,000 for film school is that I don't have those connections or ways to really get hooked up with people. It sort of took me doing work, getting out in the world for people to kind of see it and then say, I want to work with you, or me approaching someone and saying, well, I'm self-taught, but here's what I did. And then I'll say, oh, okay, I'll work with you, so it's been a real struggle to sort of meet people and to work with people and, to produce, really is what I've always looked for as a good, solid producer.
Sure, absolutely. Well, the two films I've seen of yours, Lefty and Be Good, what I love about both films is that they don't have the sort of stereotypical affectations of a film that's trying to be like real life, like staging real life. And I think there's a lot of very talented micro-budget filmmakers out there that are trying to, you know, get at some kind of truth, you know, kind of like, you know, strip a story of any of the kind of the conventional, you know, plot mechanics and really kind of get at some essence of those characters. And what one thing I think is particularly strong about your work is the camera work itself is very—it's invisible. There was never a point where I was aware of it, except if I was looking for it. It's like there's a certain point in Be Good towards the end. It's a very tense moment, and the camera gets a bit jittery. It's almost like you're feeling that same disorientation of the character. And I'm wondering—I mean, as self-taught, I mean, do you often do the cinematography? Or are you often very involved in the cinematography of your films?
That sort of depends. The first feature I did, or I guess attempted, I didn't shoot it. And I didn't really...
That was The Site?
That was The Site.
2007.
Yeah. And that was... I acted in it, and I didn't have really any control over the camera. And I sort of let the cinematographer, you know, kind of up to his own devices. And I'll never do that again, you know.
Sure.
Just, you know, it's not nothing against the cinematographer. It's just, you know, I didn't have those conversations. I was just learning, and I didn't know that you have to be really like, okay, this is my vision, and this is what you need to, you know, accomplish for me. And I was sort of like, yeah, this is kind of what I would like, but, you know, whatever you feel like doing is cool. And that's just not a way to direct a movie, direct a cinematographer. So, you know, I wish that film was shot differently. And I sort of started out the same thing for Lefty, and... You know, I wasn't going to be in Lefty, so I did hire the same cinematographer, and then I felt it was really hard to direct my actors and also direct a cinematographer, so I was like, I should just be shooting this, you know? Mm-hmm. So I went and got a DVX, and then I wound up shooting the vast majority of that movie. And then for Be Good, I was lucky enough to meet Mike Gibbesser through Frank V. Ross, and you know, and that was just a really great connection, because Mike is just very talented, and so he shot Be Good. And for Be Good, you know, I've never seen anything Mike shot otherwise, I think, to this day, even because Mike he's not very good at promoting his own showings and things like that.
Sure.
And unfortunately, because you know, everyone loves his work, and you know, I still haven't seen it, but I trusted, you know, Frank said, well, Mike just shot my movie. And I said, okay, well, you know, and Mike kind of knew the story, knew my sensibility and where I was coming from. And so I totally trusted him. Mm-hmm. And we sort of talked through things, but I kind of let Mike go. So even though I said I wouldn't do that again, you know, I wouldn't do that after doing The Site, with Mike, I would just, you know, tell him what I wanted, tell him the mood, and then he would do it and more, you know.
Sure.
So he really, you know, made the film look beautiful and just captured some just really great moments that people, you know, from the Siskel screenings, people really seem to connect to. I mean, you know, everyone talks about the cinematography in that movie that I've talked to, just how beautiful it is. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of conversations that happen between he and I, but at the same time, I gave him a lot of freedom.
Well, that's what I was wondering was the atmosphere that you create on the set, especially when you're working with a very, very young child. I mean, basically a toddler, a baby, and Be Good, because mm-hmm. that film is about two parents who are, you know, first experiencing what it's like to be parents, for, you know, having this very young child, and the mother's, you know, working. And there's a really provocative line where I think it was motherhood is the new feminism. I can't remember if a character says that or if that's a particular part of the film, but it seems like she really is wanting to be in the child's life, and the job is kind of keeping her from that. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the father, he's an artist, he's a filmmaker, and it really captures that feeling of, you know, trying to get something done and then just having that scream in the other room. Like always, you know, he feels it's like a tug of war between his computer and his child.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, just in terms of the atmosphere that you want to create on set, when you're working with a child, I think there's even a shot where the child appears to fall asleep on camera. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering what is that? I mean, it must be a very intimate set that you have to create to get those moments.
Yeah, yeah. We, you know, there was early on in the project, you know, we were talking like it was going to be, you know, something like a $50,000 movie or something like that. You know, the more I started thinking about it, I was like, no, I just, you know, I mean, that's big to me for anyone listening. That's huge to me. The more I thought about it, the more I'm like, no, I mean, she's a very aware baby. This is Tessa, my daughter. And, you know, she's very stimulated by her environment. So, if the more people are around, the more that she would be distracted, the more she would be irritable. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I just want to, you know, kind of go keep the level of crew level that I'm sort of used to. Whereas, you know, so in this case, Be Good was similar to Lefty. We might even have one more crew person around, but you know, it was basically Mike and, someone helping him out as an AC. And then maybe we'd have a PA. And then we would have a production manager who was sort of kind of just behind the scenes, you know, just working on food. And you know, is this girl, Bex Lieto, who was just awesome. And she sort of babysat Tess the mm-hmm. whole time, too. So we kept it really small and really quiet in order to, you know, to recreate the atmosphere of home that she's used to and comfortable with as much as possible. So within that setting, we could kind of do all these sort of daily routine things you know, in the reactions and the interactions could be relatively natural.
Sure, so. Sure. Well, and you have a wonderful little role for Joe Swanberg, who's also a Chicago filmmaker, independent filmmaker, and his own son, like a newborn son, I guess, was 1 year old at the time, Jude. And I thought that was such an interesting cameo because Joe recently did a film called Marriage Material, which was it wasn't about a couple that was married or had a child, but it was about a couple that is unmarried but babysitting a child. And you see all of the doors that opens once they have that there, the doors to all of their insecurities, everything kind of floods through when that happens. Mm. And I recently blogged about the fact that I would love for Be Good and Marriage Material to have like a double feature, like a double bill, like all like just in like art house theaters, you know, across mm-hmm. the nation, because I think they complement each other really beautifully, but they're they're very different. They're very particular films mm-hmm. in their own right. And one thing I think that both films kind of get at and show different sides of is that whole conflict of when you're an artist, how do you balance like an artistic profession, an artistic endeavor with having a child that has very specific, you know, financial needs, you know, there's right. very certain things you have to live up to. And I'm wondering, was any of that, yeah, I mean, obviously I would assume some of those, you know, same anxieties would go through your mind as a filmmaker or just things that you and your wife may have talked about, you know, when you had mm-hmm. kids. Was any of that, you know, was that a personal sort of like...
Yeah, you know, the reason I sort of picked a filmmaker for the characters because I wanted to kind of you know, portray the environment that's sort of more popular now. Mm. That, you know, you have parents that, you know, before it was like let's go back to Mr. Mom or something, you know, just
sure.
to make the obvious comparison. That's really not a comparison, but you know, so the dad's home and he's just home, right? And the mom's at work and she's just at work. Whereas, you know, today it's like everyone's working from home or wherever mm-hmm. they are, you know? And, you know, that is a very common thing, is for someone to be working at home and also, you know, kind of taking care of a baby. So, you know, I wanted to set up that scenario. And I think, you know, the reason I picked an artist specifically, you know, it could have been like an entrepreneur and stuff, you know, I was sort of mulling that around. But I do think it was important to be an artist, too, because being an artist is sort of different than any other entrepreneurial pursuit in the fact that, you know, there's no guarantee that anything you do, there's a guarantee more or less that you're not going to make any money at it, you know, mm-hmm. as an artist, as an independent filmmaker, you know, you're virtually guaranteed to not make money. You're virtually guaranteed to lose money. So, you know, I'm thinking of like, is this pursuit filmmaking when you have this awesome responsibility of a kid, you know, is it a worthwhile pursuit in that context, you know? So, you know, it's obviously something that was going through my head, but, you know, more about the world too is, like, you know, it's also a sad fact that you know, there's little value placed on art, I think. You know, there's very small monetary value placed on it. You know, I come from a world where I spent 8 years as a construction manager, and you know, I could have been half asleep most of the time, you know, at my job, and still did a decent job, but would have gotten, you know, a paycheck every week, you know.
Sure, yeah.
So, like, and I just think there's just such a value to something like that, construction, and, you know, obviously, oh yeah, you get paid for that because you worked hard all day, and, you know, but when there's an artist who's like, oh, that's nice, you know, and, oh, I really loved it and that, you know, but there's very few people willing to, you know, make that a more sustainable thing.
Sure.
Or, you know, I just got to get better, I guess. I don't know. But, you know, I guess the whole point is, like, how artistry is just, there's very little chance of making money at it. So where does that come as a priority in life when you have this awesome responsibility of a child?
Sure. Well, I mean, you've also done some wonderful documentaries as well. I did see Lollywood, this recent film that you made. And it was. I mean, in terms of an ode to art, I mean, you're seeing what the role of, you know, theater and performance gives these children. What was the name of this village, this part of the world that you were in when you were making this film?
That was filmed in Liberia,
Liberia.
Africa. Yeah,
that's right. Mm-hmm. And so you may actually made like a couple documentaries, a couple films in Liberia. And so, what was it about that part of the world that attracted you? How did you even get exposed to that part of the world and maybe explore it?
Well, Liberia, first, a long story is that my wife and I went to Honduras about 3.5 years ago, and we did some work, and I shot a documentary down there. And this organization that we were working with in Honduras also had a boarding school in Liberia. And when we came back from Honduras, this organization had some problems, and my wife became the basically the executive director of the Liberia boarding school. She's based in Chicago here, but, you know, she was the executive director of that boarding school in Liberia. It's called Liberia Mission International, and now the sort of parent organization is called Franciscan Works. I encourage people to check it out, franciscanworks.org. It's a great initiative, for lack of a better word. But anyway, so they sent me over there and the fall of 2010 to kind of make a promotional video for him. So it was supposed to be like 1 5-minute thing. And then that quickly grew into a 6-part web series, The Children of Hope, that you mentioned. Just because I was like, you know, I started meeting these kids and they had just these incredible stories about, you know, how far they've come since the Civil War, which is totally brutal Civil War that happened in Liberia. So in that 2-week trip, I did that. I was primarily there to do Children of Hope, but I also wanted to shoot a narrative short when I was there, so I made a narrative short with one of the kids, and it's called Son of Nun, and that did pretty well on the Fest circuit, and
that
won Slam Dance and stuff. And
that's right.
That was really
the special
cool.
jury award at Slam Dance.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So that was awesome. Yeah, I couldn't believe that won that. But while I was there, I also shot this the footage for Lollywood, and I never edited it into the documentary that I wanted to edit. When I got these Siskel screenings, the program was a little short because Be Good has a shorter running time, and I was like, well, I might as well just cut together this piece of these kids doing the show and, you know, see where that goes, and it wound up turning out really, really cool. And, you know, to explain it more, it's just while I was shooting this documentary and this narrative short, one of the kids approached me and said, can you film the older kids doing a show? And the next day, he had 30 kids cast in their roles, and they all knew their lines. A day later, we planned to shoot it, and he said, come out to the field and shoot this thing. And I went out there literally 48 hours after he initially approached me, and they built an entire African village. Mm. And they really only built that village in 3 hours, and then had this really elaborate sort of soap opera based on these Nollywood movies that they watch, and it was hilarious. But it was just so mind-blowing that they could just throw all this together, have this really intricate story, and have it, you know, like a real, interesting arc and thematically, you know, it was really deep. And but it was just, you know, when the thing is just like when you give a kid some kind of canvas that doesn't have it, you know, what they can do with it, and it just totally blew my mind. So I just filmed a little bit for a documentary on them making this, and that turned into Lollywood. So hopefully that that gets more out in the world too, because you know it's really remarkable what these kids did.
It's just, it's extraordinary footage, because it just, you see how, you know, people who want to create art, it's like they have to. It's like it's not really a decision. It's like if you're an artist, you just have to create. You have to do this. And even if that's not like a particular, you know, profession that someone has, there's always that artistic side that has to be let out in one way or another. And I mean, going between documentaries and the narratives, I mean, it seems like they must affect each other in some way. Or are there similar techniques that you're utilizing within a narrative that you kind of apply to documentary and so forth, or do you see them as pretty separate worlds in your, at least in your approach?
I mean, I guess they're really only separate in the sense that you have to have talking heads in, you know, a documentary. Well, you don't have to, but you know, I in all the documentaries I've done, you know, they've included talking heads. But I mean, I really prefer a fly on the wall approach to a documentary, which I sort of either consciously or subconsciously try to make my movies like that, where, you know, I think like you were saying, you know, where you're not aware of the camera, like just, you know, you're observing a scene, you're observing things happening. It doesn't look set up. And, you know, so I can't say that my narratives are docu-style, although Son of Nun is technically a docudrama, and that's how everyone's, you know, that reviewed it is,
Been labeling it.
So, you know, whatever. You know, I'm fine. And that Son of Nun is definitely different than, say, you know, Lefty or Be Good. But, you know, the natural approach, I think, to narrative filmmaking is still there, whether it's docudrama or not. But, you know, I don't see them as a big jump creatively. You know, you can tell, oh, that's a documentary, this is a narrative. And, you know, I do like to construct a story for narratives. I do like, you know, seeing something that's interesting or a character and, you know, what would happen with that if this happened, you know? So I like constructing a story to make a narrative, but I, you know, I do like observing some kind of scene or something going on in the real world and just, you know, seeing where it goes, which we did in Honduras. And, you know, like you said, with Lollywood, you know, just telling a story that's real, you know, some things are just better off just to be non-manipulated into a story and just kind of just showing someone's experience and making it real. So that's sort of the approach I take to documentaries.
Oh, sure. And I don't want to give the impression that these are like self-conscious docu-style, because they aren't. It is, I think, Fly on the Wall is a better way of putting it. And I mean, in Lefty, you have all these scenes of just guys being guys. I mean, it's this, you know, male, you know, friendship, you know, all these guys coming together. So some guy just came back from Iraq, and the guys are, you know, welcoming him home. And the main character, I love this. He's a guy who just he can never let out what's really going on. There's there's this personal pain that he's hiding, and I was wondering if that was almost something you wanted to comment on as like a uniquely American trait. Of you know, people who, you know, if that's something that we as Americans do, is just hide certain things, you know.
Did you read that somewhere? Did you read that in my press material, or did you just come up with that?
That was something that I saw, because I mean, we was talking. I did read the press material after that.
But I'm not sure if I even wrote that. But I mean, that's exactly how I explain like what he's going through. And
sure, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's
it must have been one of those. There's like little production notes on the DVD, which I do recommend to people if they to check it out. But I must have picked up on that. So
I was hoping that you just kind of picked up on that as opposed to read something. So,
sure.
But anyway, yeah, that's exactly what I was going for. I think that's totally the way I was raised. Not me personally, but you know, the lead character too, and the guy who plays the guy coming home from Iraq, Billy Phelan. Tommy Madden is the same lead in Lefty as Be Good.
Mm-hmm. And wonderful actor.
Really. Oh, yeah. It's just fantastic. And we all grew up in the same neighborhood in Beverly on the south side of Chicago, very Irish Catholic neighborhood. And, you know, the Irish Catholic are famous for, you know, not complaining. Mm-hmm. And you, instead of complaining, you drink. So whether it's a stereotype or not, it's sort of what how we experience, you know, our problems. We simply just do not ask for help, you know. And I think that that's, you know, basically a microcosm of the greater American, that's, you know, the greater American, I'm not going to say dilemma, but the trait of of this rugged individualism, you know, of this really, you know, real reluctance to ask for help. And I the reason I put Iraq in there, because I think 9/11 Iraq is just was just a real manifestation of that. You know, it's just like, ah, we're in charge. You know, we're not vulnerable or wounded. Someone attacked us. Yeah, now we're gonna go out and, you know, show everyone how tough we are and stuff. You know, whereas like, actually, you know, if we were a little bit more humble, we could, we need some help, like kind of getting back up and, you know, instead of being a fake, like, unilateralism in Iraq, you know, it was just all American. And then these people kind of helped out and, you know, but, you know, I really wanted to explore that whole thing and how it affects, you know, individuals. Because that's exactly Danny, what's the lead's name in Lefty, you know, he has this horrible problem and he's making it much worse by not telling anyone, you know, and not seeking help. And I see that everywhere. Like, you know, we're really reluctant to show how vulnerable we are. And those vulnerabilities just inevitably come out the more we pretend we're not vulnerable, you know? So it's so dumb, you know, it's like, you know, you're much more strong when you can ask for help and receive help. And, you know, it's just this weird oxymoron that we, a lot of us, you know, live with. And I'm super guilty of it myself, you know.
I think it's something anyone can relate to, absolutely, because they feel that they're somehow less, I mean, especially for men, like less masculine if they're, you know, asking for help. Right. It's like they just want to. And so, I mean, I thought that was a very compelling theme. And also when I read it in the press notes, I was like, I have to bring that up. And there was another thing I read, too, about IO, about one of their philosophies at Improv Olympic is you have to say yes to the scene while surrendering your own ideas. I wanted to write that down because I thought that was a very interesting principle to apply to cinema, where you really do need, you know, a certain dramatic arc, a certain structure. And I'm wondering how you kind of work within that when you're doing like a whole, you know, coherent, cohesive film, and not like lose track of the story. Is that a certain balancing act you have to?
Yeah, it was a real struggle with Lefty. You know, when I, again, going back to the site where I let my cinema photographer do anything, I was, I had a structure and I had basically a script for Lefty, but I let my actors play around with the, you know, the lines, et cetera. But what really happened in Lefty with the problem is like real life really changed. I mean, it was always supposed to be sort of loose and organic, but, you know, this thing went on and on and, you know, people lives got in the way and no one's a professional actor with the exception of Tommy. And, you know, people had their real lives. So all these real life things impeded us from doing what the script said. So we had to continually adjust. So for like a whole year, I was just really figuring out, like, you know, and it would just be as simple as, you know, Tommy would have a commercial shoot and he would have to, or a commercial audition, and he would have to shave. And he had a beard in Lefty. And, you know, that you have to, like, change the entire movie to see how this beard grows, or, you know, and it presented a lot of challenges. But as what's awesome in improv is that once you do surrender your own ideas and just say yes to the situation that you walk into, like, this collaboration takes over, and you know, it becomes something much more great than you would have anticipated, and especially more great than your individual ideas would have brought to it. I mean, if we did the thing, you know, directly per my direction, it would have been a lot easier for me to do, but I can't say that it would be, it's very unlikely that it would have been as good.
Sure. Well, and I think that's both your films, both your narratives are really a triumph that I've seen are both a triumph of editing as well, because that gives so much of the form too of all those beautiful scenes. And so just last of all, I have to ask just what's next for you? What's the next thing you're kind of
I get well
because we I mentioned the adaptation that you're working on. Is there other projects as well, or what is that?
Yeah. So this adaptation, I am actually. Sunday, I'm going to take off and seclude myself for like almost a week so that I can finish that project.
Very cool.
At least finish the screenplay, you know.
It's a saint on death row, and it's by this New York Times bestselling author, Thomas Cahill. So that's very exciting. Yeah,
so I'm gonna pound out that script next week. It's been just simmering for a long time and incubating, and I've been just doing a ton of research, and then, you know, took some time off for Be Good. But I think I'm finally in a place, I have, you know, like the logistical freedom to take off for a week because I found some other work. But, you know, the something just opened up in this week, presented itself. So I'm going to go and pound out that script. And then as far as films go, I think I'm just going to, it just seems more logical that, you know, I'm just going to do shorts from now on, unless, you know, if Saint on Death Row comes through and, you know, I'm involved in that, that'd be great. But yeah, I've just had this idea of doing, you know, these sort of O. Henry-esque shorts.
Sure.
Not real adaptations, but something along those lines.
Very cool. I'll be looking forward to that. And where's the best place for people to find your work? Where's the that you would recommend?
Well, I think, I don't know. I mean, everything's on my site. Son of None, I still have to figure out the distribution. I have to finalize it. It's like the contract's been sitting in my inbox for a while, so I got to sign that and get that done. And hopefully it's still valid, but that's going to be distributed through Watt Media. Who does good? It's a really good shorts distributor. And Lefty, I sell DVDs off my site. And Lollywood, hopefully, will be at Fest coming up. And Be Good, I think, you know, the next screening we have is roughly scheduled for September 14th at the Beverly Arts Center.
Oh, very cool.
So, hopefully that's going to go through. And other than that, you know, I don't know.
Awesome. Why don't you just say your site right now, so we'll just get that on there.
Yeah, my site is www.obrigadoproductions.com, and obrigado is thank you in Portuguese, so hopefully that'll make it easier for you to remember. But that, yeah, that's my company, basically, Obrigado Productions.
And obrigado to you, Todd, for being here. So.
I wish I could remember what welcome was, but... Obrigado to you.
Awesome. Thank you very much. And for all my recent reviews and interviews, you can check out HollywoodChicago.com. That concludes today's episode of Indie Outlook. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm, and I invite you to tune in next time for more coverage of the latest and greatest in modern independent cinema. Till then, I'll be on the lookout.